from the mind of the sapient simian. This is Nobody's Prodigy. Free-range ideas from beyond the box. This is the Sapient Simian, and welcome to Nobody's Prodigy, episode 34. An episode I'm going to call Dig the Future. Now, urban sprawl, suburban sprawl, deforestation, the destruction of rainforests, climate change, population density rise, affordable housing, the need for increase in food production, and developing a resistance to natural disasters are all major issues hanging over the heads of not just one country or one culture in the years to come, but indeed entire species and the healthy survival of the entire planet. Many people choose to ignore the reality of these issues, either being willfully ignorant or fatalistically resigned to the inevitable catastrophe. Others intend to continue precisely as they always have, on the faith that science will somehow save them. In the past century, humanity has collectively looked to space overhead as an exit strategy, but perhaps the smarter move is not upward, but downward. Now, the starting point for this is an analogy that I heard someone say at one point. It was a scientist, and they said, when you think about the Earth and you imagine all of what's called the biosphere is the part of the Earth that actually contains all of the life in it, all of the parts that make up us with the plants and the trees and the animals and the birds and the bacteria and all that kind of thing. If you imagine that like an apple, how big do you think the biosphere is on the planet Earth? And they said that the biosphere, including the atmosphere itself, which is the entirety of the air that we breathe, is actually about the thickness of the skin of that apple. And if you've ever cut into an apple, you realize that the skin of that apple is just the tiniest little line along the outside. And everything that has to do with the living biosphere of the Earth takes place on that very, very thin layer. And all of life and everything that has to do with life happens in that very thin layer. Now, the whole rest of the apple is not negligible. It has a lot of things going on. It's the source of the gravity that actually pulls us downward, which is very important. But as far as our survival and the survival of life itself on Earth is concerned, that very thin layer of the biosphere is what is in danger in the future, and it is what is the most fragile. And when we look at things like climate change and the extinction of species and all of those sorts of things happen along that very thin layer. Now, the one thing that kind of spurned my attention to this thought, other than the usual doom proclamations that tend to happen when it comes to news and information around climate change and the impending disasters, have to do with the fact that I live in an area of particular natural beauty. I live in the Appalachian Mountains, and around me, I'm blessed to have lots and lots of forest area. And in my particular area, there happen to be a lot of animals and things that are very unusual in most places on the planet, and especially in most places on the East Coast where it happens to be particularly developed. Over the course of my lifetime and over the course of the last several years in particular, a lot of the areas that I grew up around that were particularly dear to me in the sense of being beautiful or something that I very much appreciated that were forest lands or otherwise beautiful natural areas have been developed. And developed is the nice way of saying destroyed in my mind. But what ends up happening is that someone will come in and will tear down the forest, will bulldoze everything down, and will put in a house, usually. A lot of times they'll put in a business or something of that sort, but generally speaking, they will destroy the forest and will put in some sort of man-made structure for the purposes of man to build. Now, I notice as I see this happening again and again, not only does it cause a lot of frustration and anger in me to see these places destroyed and then replaced with something that is generic and at least generally ecologically useless in my mind, which is to say it does nothing to replace what it has destroyed, But it also exposes to me the loss of effective habitat for things that are around in that area. And I have noticed in my particular space itself a real influx of what were considered to be wild animals that when I was younger were very rare, just because they had areas to go that were not next to my house, and they have been forced into smaller and smaller alcoves that now live right beside me, and I make a purpose to make them as comfortable as possible in that area. But as I see these places being built, the one thing that I eventually was able to notice is that when these houses and buildings are being built, most of the time, the order of operations, of course, goes destroy the forest, flatten everything down, and then dig a foundation. And I noticed that when you dig a foundation, in just a few inches or feet, you pretty much hit, at least in this area, a hard pack of red clay. And as someone who does gardening and has plants in their family sphere, I know that red clay is basically a useless substance in the sense that for the ecological environment, red clay is not something that anything can grow in, not something that anything can particularly use. There are animals that can burrow into it because it is dry and hard and nothing particularly bothers it, so that you can get animals burrowing into it to a certain extent, but even then those burrows only go a few feet into the ground. And essentially they use it because it is otherwise completely inhospitable. So you find these areas where, effectively speaking, if you look at a cross-section, you have what was a beautiful jungle or forest area with lots of wild animals, and then you have a few feet of soil, and then you have endless amounts of feet of red clay and useless, non-productive biological material. And that got me thinking about, as I said, that thin layer of the biosphere that we so desperately need and depend on. And I got to looking at the cross-sections of various kinds of ecosystems. Now, if you look at the cross-sections of jungles and even old-growth forests, studies have found that these ecosystems are actually very shallow when it comes to depth into the ground. Trees, in ideal situations, can grow roots as deep as about 20 feet. 7 foot to 9 feet is about typical for a fully mature tree to grow the depths of their roots. But shallow and wide spreading roots are the norm in almost every situation. Now, there are trees that can grow tap roots that go quite far, upwards of 33 feet and more. Some trees in certain very specific situations have grown roots well beyond 150 feet, but those are very, very rare. And the important thing to remember is that in all of these cases, the trees will grow until the point that it becomes no longer productive. So in a situation where you only have a few feet before you hit a red clay or a hard pack surface, or even the bedrock of the actual area, the roots are not going to go beyond that. They will stop at that point and spread out and do their thing from there. So in any situation, it will only go as deep as the dirt itself allows it to go. And most of the tree's roots are only within the upper 6 to 12 inches of soil. It should also be said that most of the tree's roots are a very fine, functional, hair-like root, not the giant bulky branch type roots. Those roots are supportive roots that hold the tree up, but that also means that they spread out in such a way to actually prop the tree up and are not necessarily the sort that reach for sources of nutrients. The nutrient roots are the thinner hair-like roots. And if you've ever pulled up a plant and exposed the roots, you will notice that there is a lot of sort of hair and fluff on that root ball. And that's actually the functioning roots of the tree. Those are the roots that actually collect the water and the nutrients. And the stiff, hard, branch-like roots are actually the support roots, which are not nearly as long-reaching in most cases. And even when they are long-reaching, they will generally go in a direction that is meant to hold up the tree, which is outward and not necessarily downward. And as I said, in every case, as soon as those roots going downward hit a surface that is unyielding or a surface that is unproductive, like a clay layer or a stone layer, they will stop. They do not feel any need to go beyond that because there's no point, there's no need for it. Now, the other situation that you find yourself in, which I think is also interesting, is farmland. I also happen to live in an area where there's quite a lot of farmland, usually pasture land for animals. And in farmland, even in the most extreme circumstances as far as farmland goes, the deepest crops that you can get, according to what I have read, the deepest farmland soils are going to go about 4 feet into the ground. And that's for the absolute deepest crops. On average, your crops are going to stay in what's called the topsoil. The topsoil is actually the functioning layer of soil. It's the soil that actually has the nutrients that is good. If you dig it up, it's the brown, loamy soil that actually is the good soil that you put down if you're trying to grow something. And the U.S. average for all of the farmland in the United States is 8 inches of topsoil. So there's 8 inches of functional topsoil. Now, generally speaking, according to the standard, you need anywhere from 10 to 30 centimeters to have the minimum amount of topsoil. But even that is less than the 4 foot that is considered the maximum for farmland. So there again, even among other uses that are not old growth forest uses, the land doesn't need to be any deeper than 4 feet. And really, in an old growth forest, 20 feet is ample, and that's assuming you have excellent soil for that 20 feet. In a situation where you have poorer soils or you have erosion and things that cut down on the amount of good soil, the functioning portion of a forest could be very, very few actual feet. Like I said, 7 foot to 9 feet deep is typical for a forest, and anything below that is going to be essentially not being used by the ecosystem. Now, the other thing that's interesting about farmland is that not only is the U.S. average 8 inches of topsoil, but that 8 inches actually goes down every year. We are actually losing topsoil every year because of the way that we do our farmland. And this is after all of our years of adjusting the ways in which we do farmland, the ways in which we rotate crops, and the ways in which we plow things in order to try to minimize that as much as possible. Every year, from 1 year to the next, we actually lose soil every single year. And this is basically due to wind and water. The wind-blown loss of topsoil and the water erosion continues to make the farming soils worse. And this is essentially because of the exposure to the weather and to the elements that happen within the weather. And of course, the problem with that too is when you have that erosion, you also have the erosion of the pesticides and of fertilizers that are put on those fields to try to keep them in good condition and try to grow those crops to better conditions. And those pesticides and fertilizers go on to contaminate the waters of the areas around, including the drinking waters and the water supplies that are actually in the ground that people use with wells to drink from. So in a sense, even our best we can do now with farming as it exists is going to ruin itself. It is terminable. It is limited fundamentally by time in a way that cannot be sustained. Now, it could be argued, and I think it's probably difficult to argue otherwise, that the most effective use of the biosphere, the most effective use of any land is as natural habitat, and that natural habitat is the best use of land with animals living on it and the natural ecology. It has been shown in many places that if you allow a place to go back into a natural form, it will actually rehabilitate the soils and will make the area better. And it could be argued also that if you can supplement that natural habitat with human interaction, you can actually speed up that process and you can make that process more effective more quickly. And in a sense, we could repair our environment many, many times faster than it took us to destroy it if we were willing to work with nature in the way that nature wants to work and allow it to do the things it wants to do. But in urban and suburban environments, which is the spaces that we make as people, and even in rural environments with farmland, we break all of those things up. We destroy the natural environments. And in urban and suburban environments, in cities and in the suburbs around cities, We break up those places with roads, with fences, with buildings, with changes in elevation, with our own gardens, with farmland itself. You always want to limit the amount of animals that get inside. You stop things from moving in between them. And a lot of times in farm and pasture land, the people that own those things have to actively fight against the natural creatures in that environment as a way of defending their crops, defending their livestock, and preventing any kind of contamination or damage that would happen otherwise. So not only do the actual practices themselves damage the ground and the soil and the environment, but it makes the people that are engaged in that behave in ways that force them to actually act against those things. Now, if you look at things as I was doing when I was looking at the excavation of these homes in these freshly destroyed pristine forests around here, in the side view, in the apple skin view, the biosphere itself, nature, and the natural environment that we are destroying only needs a very thin skin along the surface in order to be perfectly healthy, in order to be happy and functioning and very comfortable. We, on the other hand, and the things that we do, our actual activities, are more than capable of moving downward in that situation. We can actually move our homes and our businesses and our transportation and even the growth of our foods underground beneath the biosphere itself and be perfectly functional in much the same way as we are. As I sit here in this room and record this podcast, I am just as capable of doing this in a high rise or on a houseboat or underneath the ground or out in an open field, assuming it was quiet enough. My activities can happen anywhere. If I were an oak tree, there's really only certain situations in which I can do that. So in a situation where me and the oak tree are struggling to coexist, I'm the one that can move. It really can't. So with that in mind, you can look at that situation and see that by moving, we can have some real positives and deal with some real negative implications that we would otherwise struggle with. So with that idea in mind, I want to imagine the idea of an underground city. An underground city could be built much the same way as it is built above ground, because cities themselves are contrived environments. Cities are man-made environments. As I said, an apartment is an apartment, whether it's above ground or below ground. There are things that people imagine in their heads when they think about the idea of living underground, and I'll deal with those in a little bit. But in terms of a living room or a bedroom or a kitchen, whether it's above ground or below ground, it doesn't fundamentally change in a functional way. And the idea of an underground farm. Well, an underground farm is in many ways better than above ground farming. You can have an underground farm that is flat, an underground farm that is engineered in such a way that you actually have better distribution of water, better lighting, better crop rotation, and there's a lot of other kinds of things that I can get into in a sec as well. If you have underground transportation, you have the ability to go directly from one destination to another. You no longer have to go around obstacles or up and down elevations. And just those things alone allow for enormous changes in efficiency of transportation. If you can go from one area in a straight line somewhere else, you take out so much of the wasted energy to get there. Not to mention, in those situations, you have the ability to develop systems that may be too fragile to exist in exposure to nature itself. You can develop systems that need to be kept dry, or need to be kept clean, or need to be kept smooth, or in any of those sorts of things that would be difficult to do if it were traveling through the natural environment in general. And you develop situations where these transportation systems can be created and maintained in safety from outside influences of weather or obstruction or anything of those sorts involving snow, involving landslides. I know, for example, one of my favorite countries, Norway, have actually invested quite a bit of money in developing underground highways. And they are developed with ventilation in a certain way that allows that to be possible. But the main advantage to having underground highways is they have large amounts of snowfall throughout a vast portion of the year. But with an underground highway, you don't have to deal with any snow removal. And in fact, you can actually create an environment that is far safer, far cleaner, and far cheaper to maintain simply by making the initial investment of digging the underground highway to begin with. And these highways are well known for being comfortable and effective and for making things far easier on the country without damaging what is also one of the country's main assets, which is their pristine wilderness areas. So that is a really clear and direct example of something that's happening right now that doesn't involve the creation of vastly new technologies, but simply the implementation of things that we already know. Now, the number one thing that I think people think about when it comes to living underground is this idea of claustrophobia or a lack of space. But large spaces could be constructed underground just as they are anywhere else. And in certain situations, it may actually be easier. Essentially speaking, the mechanics of creating a large space are essentially the same no matter where you're at. Provided you have the support structure needed, there's no basic limitation to the volume you could dig out. You would just have to put in the proper supports for that space. And that engineering is very well understood. And the use of modern materials and modern structures make that possible. But more importantly, if you have an area where the geology is already self-supporting, which is to say, if you're digging in bedrock that is already rock, already stone to begin with, that material supports itself to begin with. And if you look at certain mining constructions and natural cave systems, there are areas that are perfectly happily able to support themselves with vast spaces with no man-made bracing and have been there for millions of years. So there's no reason that a large area could not be created. And in these large areas, you could have things like atriums. You could have full-on forests and parks and amusement parks and beaches. You could have apartments with balconies. You could have underground cities with the equivalent of high-rises where you look down on the road below you, many stories below, because effectively speaking, there's no reason that that volume couldn't still be there. It's just that you would be under what would be a forest above you instead of being on top of the ground and having nothing above you. And again, since forests and plants and trees and the farmland itself only requires 20 feet of depth, there's no reason why you couldn't even create layers of additional forest under the ground in which you could travel and have completely man-made environments that are parklands that not only would be completely safe from natural disasters and any of those sorts of things, but could also be created in such a way that pests and diseases and any kind of exterior threats could be limited out. You could create environments in which the ecosystem itself was set up to be a specific kind of ecosystem, completely aside from whatever the ecosystem above would be. You could make a tropical area in a hemisphere of the world that was not at all tropical, or a cold area in a hemisphere of the world that was not at all cold. Because you're dealing with something that is so removed from the other environments around it and creating a space from scratch in that way that you can control what comes into and out of that space and make your own envelopes of experience. Even to the extent of, like I said, making a beach or a lake or anything of those kinds, and bringing in animals, bringing in fish, bringing in anything that you would want to bring in that situation. And all of those things become possible because all of those things can be planned over time, and by exploring the geology of the area, you can actually decide what makes the most sense, and then decide as a community to expand certain areas. And the good thing is, once something is built, it doesn't get overgrown. It doesn't have the issues of the encroachment of nature and weathering and all those sorts of things on it. To a certain extent, if you're digging into bedrock, it's dug into. Once that material is removed, it doesn't come back. So it allows for a progressive growth that means that ground is not lost in the same way that it would be lost if you were, say, trying to clear out a forest or a jungle to make space for something. The other thing, too, is that in that situation, with those kinds of checks and balances, you do have a lot of security. For some people, that's a double-edged sword, but at the same time, that security is something that is guaranteed and can be a positive. The number one thing that people think of when they think of underground situations are earthquakes, but seismic zones, areas where earthquakes are possible, are well-known, well-documented, and very easy to keep track of in the sense that for everywhere that earthquakes happen, there are areas where earthquakes have never happened and will probably never happen, or if they do, they happen on a very minimal extent. And it's also possible to build with stability of those things in mind. While that is not a negligible thing, you have to also think of the many, many other natural disasters that would not at all phase your situation. Basically, every other kind of natural disaster is nothing to worry about. So yes, there is a possibility that there may be a slight tremor that has to be dealt with at some point. But as a community, I think that we're capable of dealing with those issues. And in much the same way that we have natural disaster responses to deal with the many other kinds of hurricanes and tsunamis and floods and forest fires and tornadoes, and the mind boggles at the number of things, I think that we can deal with the other things as well. But the good thing to remember is that these situations, the security within them is very, very, very good. I mean, there is a very good reason why bomb shelters and fallout shelters are put underground, because when you are underground in that way, you are remarkably secure and remarkably stable and remarkably protected from outside influences. So that's definitely worth looking into. And as far as the space and the idea of claustrophobia and the idea of security and being kept in and all that sort of thing goes, it's also important to remember that the trade-off in this situation would be essentially limitless access through lots of small points to unending pristine nature. Because what you're doing is you're moving all this stuff underground so that on the surface itself, it's nothing but national parks, nothing but natural environments, waterfalls, and beautiful creatures. It's not to say that you necessarily need to give up on those areas and have no control over them. I think that it would be far more likely for people to actively engage in those spaces and to develop areas that were specifically planted. And that's another thing to do with the farming itself, which is to say that you could develop what are called edible forests, which are forests that are designed to be food producing, and areas where there are things growing that are beneficial not just to nature, but also to humanity itself. There are a lot of plants and things that would be perfectly happy to grow in an area that you could plant on the surface and would cause no harm to the area and would actually be a benefit that you could then go to the surface to gather without needing to be destructive to that environment. There are all sorts of natural herbs and naturally occurring native species and things that would actually expand and become more likely in an area where the natural environment was allowed to expand that are not there now. And in a sense, what you would really do are move unproductive or unhelpful crops underground. You would have places underground that would grow things like corn or wheat or monolithic crops that are unhelpful in a varied environment, and things that need a lot of human intervention, things that need a lot of pesticides or things that need a lot of intensive human care. And it's interesting when it comes to food production, because when you look at the alternatives to the traditional method of growing crops, and what is possible in an underground human-controlled situation, you actually have far better statistical output for that situation. Because when you're in an underground situation, you have a controlment of humidity and temperature in a way that you'd never do elsewhere, and you have the complete avoidance of any kind of external impact of frosts or lack of rain or too much rain or, as I said, the pests or diseases and those sorts of things. They're all controlled because you're in a controlled environment. And you actually end up with estimates of as much as 10 times the crop yields for the same amount of area. Not to mention, you run into the ability to have all-year crops, because instead of the natural way in which we grow crops, which is that we plant them in the spring when we reap them in the fall, in a situation that's controlled by man in that way, you can actually control the lighting and the temperature in such a way that as soon as one crop is ready to be reaped, you can go ahead and plant the next crop, because there is not a winter, so to speak, in that situation. You can just skip over it and go straight to planting again. Or if you have a crop that only takes a short amount of time to be ready to pick, something that is green, like a spinach or something like that, you can pick it and plant another one in its place, even if the plant beside it is not yet ready, in which case you have constant growth, unending production that never stops. And in addition to that, this is all assuming that you're still using a traditional type of crop growth in the sense of having dirt and those sorts of things that you would otherwise have. There are a number of newly developed ways of growing crops that would become possible in that situation that would actually be even better. There are things like hydroponics, where you grow things in no soil at all, but you actually use water that has fertilizers and things in the water so that you don't use soil. And that allows you to control a lot of things that you would not otherwise be able to control, and it keeps you from having to replenish soils and that kind of thing, because you are very carefully measuring things out. Now, what happens a lot of times is that you'll actually connect the water from those hydroponics into a system where you are farming fish, and the fish can actually live off the output of the water from the crops, and the crops actually live off the waste from the fish. So it creates this really good system where you can actually do both off of each other. They do well together. And again, in a situation of that kind, that man-made situation, you're actually getting far more production in a far smaller area. But again, both of those things are removed from the environment to where you can control for any kind of disease or otherwise. And not to mention, you're not competing with the natural system in the way that you're throwing off other natural food webs and those sorts of things that can damage other species that are not within that sphere. As good as those are, there also exist things like aeroponics, and aeroponics is a fairly new development. Aeroponics actually doesn't use liquid water, it uses a mist, and a mist within a root structure that's simply hanging in an enclosed environment. So it uses no soil, and it essentially uses almost no water. It actually uses 90% less water than hydroponics, and it requires no pumps to run it, so it actually uses less energy as well. Of course, all of these things allow for the possibility of using automation to actually harvest, which makes it possible to have far higher output in a far smaller space. And at the same time, you're allowing nature to grow and to flourish and to rebuild itself. So you're getting the best of both worlds. And you're losing, or you're rather avoiding, the erosion problems, the pesticide problems, and the pollution that comes from the traditional methods of farming. One of the key things I think is interesting in this is that it would involve the development of new crops over time. I think that in the same way that our agricultural development changed as we moved from hunter-gatherer society to the traditional agriculture, and how it has changed now from the traditional way of doing agriculture to higher industrial rates of agriculture. I think if you move into a situation where you are growing in these stabilized environments, or alternatively, you are growing things within a fully wild environment, then you have two different tracks for which crops can develop. On the one hand, you have completely wild things that are grown in completely natural environments and gathered in a non-structured way, things like herbs and some of the more obscure plants and things that used to be a lot more prominent but that were outcompeted by man-made crops. And then you have man-made crops that then move completely into a man-made scenario where you have the ability to engineer those crops to be higher output in shorter amounts of time and an automated process to where you really can move beyond the limitations of environmental pressures in a natural environment. Of course, these ideas are not without issues, and I do want to kind of mention these things and sort of address the ways that I look at them. The number one issue I think a lot of people would think of and that comes to mind, at least for me, I can admit to being slightly, well, I am claustrophobic. I do have issues with spaces, and my number one issue has to do with air, has to do with ventilation. And I think ventilation is one thing that would be inevitable in anyone's mind and certainly is inevitable in my mind. But the thing about ventilation is that there exists natural examples of ventilation in the sense of there are termite mounds in Africa that are actually built by termites that are blind and are vast underground structures. And what they end up building are these chimneys, these natural chimney-shaped structures that are built up. You can see pictures of them online if you look up termite mounds that actually rise up into the air. And because of the natural function of the wind on these chimneys, they will automatically, with no power usage at all, serve to ventilate the entire hive of termites. And the use of these ventilation chimneys is entirely possible to be constructed and built in. Because when you think about it, in a forest environment, you could have the piercing of structures through that thin skin of the apple and still maintain a perfectly healthy environment for animals. So if you had structures that came through that were snorkels of a sense or chimneys of a sense that would actually go up into the upper atmosphere or even just high into the atmosphere, there exists high winds at that point, and then you have a chimney effect where those high winds actually create a suction that pull the air out from the lower parts of the depth to which they go. And it's the way a carburetor works. It's the way a regular chimney works. It's the way that everything works in the sense of the way that that wind works. And that would cause the air to be sucked out from the lower depths and renewed by air that could be pulled in from slightly lower down. That would be a method of ventilation that would require no electrical use and would be completely effective and would be benign in the sense that it would not affect the natural environment around it and would be fairly easy to maintain because, as I said, it doesn't really use moving parts of any kind. And then, of course, if you're going to have underground growing rooms and underground atriums and underground parks and all of these kinds of underground areas that things already grow, all of those places could also be used as areas where air would be refreshed and would be renewed. Any kind of farmland would certainly function as all planted areas do in the sense of creating oxygen and those kinds of things. And they would help to filter the air around them. Of course, you could also go the route of having man-made filters and having active blowing fans. And of course, I think in anyone's individual space, they would certainly feel better knowing that they have a certain measure of control to have forced air ventilation and filtration and that kind of thing. But it's important to realize that you could have these things with a minimum amount of energy use. The one thing that would require energy use is lighting. And I think lighting is one thing that is sort of the second thing I think people would be worried about, the idea of being underground in the dark. The thing about lighting is that for human use underground, or just for human use period, lighting is adaptable. Humans are adaptable, but lighting in each situation is adaptable and is used as needed. Now, of course, we have things like LEDs and very highly efficient ways of making lighting, but it's also possible for humans to adapt different lighting for different situations. There are certain situations in which different spectrum of light are needed. There are certain situations in which you are reading or in your house, for example, that a certain warm light is all that's necessary. And then what amount of light, whether it's a 40-watt light, 150-watt light, a 3,000-watt light, or the equivalent is necessary. We need only a certain amount of light. Then you have things like plant growth, where LEDs are used and plants can use only a certain spectrum of lights. So there are certain spectrum of lights that would just be wasteful, in which case you can cut out those spectrum and only shine the kinds of wavelengths that are actually useful for those plants. Then you have full spectrum lights that actually replace actual sunlight, in which case you could put those in large areas like the parkland areas or the amusement park areas or anywhere where people need to go to get that circadian rhythm renewed. And in those situations, it would probably make more sense to have one large light source that might even be a community light source akin to an artificial sun that would come on and go off in a way that was predictable, that would help to give the community a sense of time and a sense of the day. But then, of course, new things would be made. There are also biomass and bioluminescent situations that might be possible, and situations where things like glow-in-the-dark materials could be used. Again, based on what kind of lighting is actually necessary in which situations and in which environments. There are all sorts of lighting solutions that we have that may not work in full sun out in an open field, but would be perfectly adequate in certain situations in limited use for short amounts of time underground where you wouldn't necessarily need full lighting all the time. And you have the ability to turn off all of these things to conserve energy. You also have things like sun tunnels, sort of the equivalent to the ventilation chimneys that I spoke of earlier. A sun tunnel is basically a light source, kind of like a skylight. It's a tube that is reflective on the inside. The top of the tunnel, you have a lens, and a lens gathers all of the sunlight at the top. And then that tube goes down into the ground and snakes around, and the light bounces around within that tube, and then you have it come out at different points, and at the ends of that other end of the tube, you have another lens that then scatters that light, so that you end up with natural lighting, but it's a natural lighting that you can actually pipe around, a bit like you would pipe around water or something of that sort, so that you can have a naturally occurring light that, again, could be pierced through in comparatively small holes and would still change with the natural lighting system. Of course, you also have the ability to use video cameras and TV screens and man-made alternatives to scenery and lighting and the ability to see outside and that sort of thing. And there again, you have the very, very small source material giving you a large view that would, for humans, be sufficient in a way that for animals may not be sufficient and would still give you the sense of not missing the surface and yet allowing the surface to do what it absolutely needs to do. So there's a lot of different options by that. And a lot of times people want to say, well, but if you did renewables, then the amount of solar cells you need compared to the amount of land that you're going to use, how it balances out and everything. But you have to think in terms of what is the trade-off in actual land surface, because if you are reclaiming all of the surface land that is being used up right now and giving it back to nature, then using up a portion of that land for solar and claiming that that is not enough to be offset for the amount of energy that you're using is a bit of a difficult argument to make. However, energy is one of the biggest issues that needs to be addressed, and I do think energy is a big part of the discussion. Now, the number one thing that comes to my mind when it comes to energy that I think is very important to mention is that energy in this situation is in a drastically different scenario. And the number one thing that I really want to mention that a lot of people don't think about on the surface and don't think about in their daily lives is the use of heat pumps. Because when you use a heat pump, you can use it in many different ways, but the number one way you can use a heat pump is to go into the ground, to use the ground's natural temperature changes to either heat or cool your home. Now, if you were actually in the ground, the ground itself is there, and the ground has what's called thermal mass, which means it's a bit like a temperature battery. If you heat up the ground, it will stay a higher temperature for a very long amount of time. If you cool it down, it will stay cool for a very long amount of time. So, in a situation where everything is underground, you have the ability to store hot and cold in two separate areas collectively for everyone's use, and then simply pump the heat or the cold. You can't really pump cold, but you can move that temperature gradient around as needed within everyone's situation. So in a sense, hot and cold become a utility, become something you can just turn on. And the use of a heat pump then is either used to give heat back into the system or to take heat out of the system. And you have a situation where massive gains in efficiency are possible because normally speaking, especially in the way that we use things today, heat is just wasted. Heat is just lost into the environment and dissipates into the air and into nature, and it becomes a real problem. If you could actually store all of that energy as heat, a lot of our other uses actually involve heat. And a lot of our number one biggest wastes of energy are in the creation of heat. The biggest uses of electricity in your home are things like your refrigerator, which is removing heat, your dryer, which is adding heat, your stove, which is adding heat, or your heating and cooling system, which both are adding and removing heat. So if you have a way of dealing with those in a way that is stable and collective in the sense that you can spread it around, it makes it a completely different scenario. Not to mention, the underground environment is naturally stable at about 60 degrees. So the amount to which you need to affect that in one direction or another is far smaller. It also means that insulation is far less vital. With no heat or cooling at all, the situation will stay at about 60 degrees. So the amount of heating and cooling necessary at any given point of the year is very minimal. So the amount of energy that you need for these things is very minimal. Whereas your lighting needs go up considerably, your heating and cooling needs go drastically down, and everything involved with heating and cooling go drastically down. And comparatively, that's an entirely different trade-off. I mean, that's totally different. Now, the number one thing that comes to my mind, which is a bit difficult for me to admit because I'm not normally an advocate for it, is that if you have an underground society like this, you run into a situation where the use of nuclear energy becomes more and more logical just because you're in such a bunkerized situation to begin with that it becomes possible to create a reactor deep enough and well enough shielded that it becomes very, very safe. Now, you still run into the issue of nuclear waste, which I have always had a problem with, but the number one problems when it comes to nuclear energy is the problems of contamination and meltdown, and both of those have to do with exposure to natural environments. And if the whole point of an underground society is that you are removing yourself from the natural environment, for example, after the Chernobyl meltdown, which is the worst nuclear disaster ever, they ended up just putting a giant concrete dome around the area. So in a sense, they encased it in rock as a way of saving it. So if you already had your nuclear reactor encased in rock, then you've already taken the precaution that you would take. And as of right now, the thing that we do with nuclear waste is we encase it in rock and bury it in the ground. So that becomes harder to argue against, especially when the alternatives are any kind of fossil fuel, which doesn't make any sense at all. Now, of course, the perfect solution or the ideal would be something like geothermal, where you actually have a volcano of sorts around that you could just take the heat from that from. Because again, what you're dealing with is the creation of heat. But if you're dealing with a situation where you use heat pumps to store energy and where you're using renewables on the surface to gather energy, the amount of actual additional energy that needs to be created could be very, very, very small. So it's possible to make micro nuclear reactors that were very small and would be able to be used only when needed and could be fairly safe and have very low output of nuclear waste material. So that becomes a possibility that may or may not be necessary mostly it would be a way of getting you over the hump of balancing everything out as you moved forward, because you would want to have additional energy for construction. And the construction phase would be the most intensive and involve the most material cost and the most energy consumption to actually make. Once you were there and once it was made, you could actually cut down massively on all of those sorts of things. And construction is the big hurdle. Construction is the big thing in the room, because construction is not cheap. But it's important to remember that neither are the construction of cities, towns, homes, roads, farms, or any of those sorts of things. If you look at what it's taken to build all of those collectively, then yeah, none of that is cheap, and you're looking at building all of those things. So yes, it wouldn't be cheap, but to look at those as one giant price tag is really not fair. Once these things were built, they would only need to be maintained. It's not a situation where you're going to have a tornado come through and you'll have to rebuild it all, or a situation where you'll have a landslide wash out all your highway and you'll have to rebuild it all, or erosion will come through and you'll have to refurbish everything. There's all sorts of situations in which, in the natural environment, there's natural degradation and destruction that you would have to continually fund, continually rebuild. Those things would no longer need to happen. Once it was built and was maintained, it would be done. It would be built. So that becomes a major adjustment to the amount of money that we're talking about. You've got a couple of different options when it comes to actually building. One, of course, is that there are existing structures that could be altered and expanded. There are mines, there are even natural caves and things that have been pre-dug. And that's a possibility in the sense that they're already there. So that's a start. But those things are not really built with long-term habitation in mind. They're usually built chasing a specific substance, a specific vein. So they don't normally make a lot of sense in their layout. And a lot of times they're not built for long-term. So they're just not the greatest start, but at least they are a start and they are proof of concept in the sense that they go deep and wide and long and they're still there. And so that is something. But really, there are a couple of other options that I think are also possible. One thing you can do is the dig and cover method, which I think is good for soft soils and new areas, which is basically you dig a giant crater in a soft soil area, kind of like the red clay around here. Then you build your initial construction in that crater, and then you then cover it up and plant on top of that space. That's actually used a lot for the initial rail lines in subways. You would dig a trench, build the rail line, and then cover it over. And I think that works for areas that have soft soils, areas that haven't been built upon, areas that may already have farmland and things like that in the area. So there are no obstructions, but there's also nothing there to build off of. Those become possible because you're already dealing with, as I said, 8 inches of topsoil. You don't really have a lot. If you're building in an area that's already been destroyed in terms of wilderness area, but has not really been reclaimed by man-made structures. Now, for man-made structures, I think the idea would be to build and bury, which is to say that you would actually bury what is there. You would build berms around it and a dome over top of it and would just cover it with soil. It's kind of like if you think in terms of a green roof and just extend the sides of that green roof down to the ground. Now, the other thing that's good about the build and bury is when you think about expanding these things underground, the number one thing that a lot of construction people will think is, yes, but where do we put all the stuff we dig out? Because if you're going to dig a giant hole in the ground, you're going to have a lot of dirt or rock or whatever, rubble, come out of that giant hole. Well, the thing to remember is that most of these areas that you're reclaiming are not wilderness to begin with. So what you would do is essentially build on top of the areas you're digging out and then bury those structures with the stuff that you're digging out. So you would build and bury as you dig underneath. In a sense, what you're doing is inflating the ground space itself. You're adding air pockets in the bottom, and you're adding air pockets in the top, and you're raising the overall level of the ground by adding all this air inside it, so you're kind of making it fluffy. But then over the very top, you add the necessary soil levels and the planting to actually have a natural environment. In so doing, you're able to then absorb any of the pre-existing construction so that it's not a situation where you have to spend all the money destroying everything that already exists, because if it can be buried, then it can be kept. So what you're really looking at doing is just building the necessary things to cover the areas that need to be covered, or taking out the things that are not worth covering as a way of dealing with that. And in addition to harvesting crops, you also run into the ability to develop over time automation when it comes to digging and construction. The spoiled dirt and stuff that's used to build and cover the top of the surface can be dealt with automatically. You develop systems that use 3D printing and those sorts of things to develop structures that are predetermined to cover a set area. So if you wanted to cover something in particular, you could do it that way. And also any kind of a shear surface could be left open, in the sense that if you had a hangar, or if you imagine a cliff face is not necessarily entirely an environment in which natural surfaces would be needed. So that cliff face could still have openings that were man-made openings that would be windows or hatches or hangar openings or anything like that. That would be fine because the natural environment would still be perfectly happy coexisting with that. So you spend your time recreating that shell of the apple and allowing the skin to heal itself. Now, I admit that this solution is not without issues and challenges, and of course, it would be a paradigm shift for mankind. In my head, I can imagine the same things said about it that were said when people left farms for towns, and the same things that were said when people left towns for cities, and every other change in humanity's living style from the very beginning of hunter-gatherer society. I know that there are people that would prefer to continue to live as they always do, and would look at this change as some sort of terrible problem. There are people that said when they left their farms and went to live in the cities that, oh, it's so crowded and I can't breathe and it's so noisy and I just can't handle it. And all of those things would be said in the same way. But the strength of any species lies in its ability to adapt and survive in a changing world. And we humans are brilliant at this if we only allow ourselves the permission to make new changes for a better future. And I think that's really what I want to get at with this, is the idea that we are able to adapt. We are smart enough to come up with a better solution, and that by making these changes, we can not only fix some of the problems that we see, but we can develop a situation where we can become better as a species and better for the planet than we now are even able to be, and not only make it a better planet for the planet, but make it a better planet for ourselves and for the ways that we want to live and the things that we want to do. In that way, it's a win-win for everyone. It just requires some hard work and, yes, a bit of money in the meantime. But I think that the upsides far outweigh the downsides, even if it does mean going down in the meantime. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this long episode up. I did want to kind of put it all out there. It's something that I came up with recently, and it's just been burning a hole in my head to try to get it out. As I said, I'm an ideas guy, and this is the kind of thing that comes along, and I just can't wait to share it with somebody. So I'm glad you guys are along for the ride, and hopefully you found that interesting. Ideas like this really get in my head, and I just don't know what to do with them. I don't know where to put them or who to tell them to, and this is the one place that I can do something with them and hopefully get a little bit of peace to know that they are at least out there. So I appreciate everyone who takes the time to listen, and I appreciate everyone who takes the time to listen every week. So thank you very much. I look forward to the next one. And in the meantime, I hope you have an excellent week, and that you all take care of yourselves. I will talk to you soon. All right. Bye. If you're enjoying the show and would like to help me feed myself, keep the lights on, and continue making episodes, direct PayPal donations and other inquiries can be sent to thesapientsimian@gmail.com. That's thesapientsimian@gmail.com. I do have a Patreon page, also under The Sapient Simian, where you can get exclusive access to view my other work from years past. Paintings, designs, projects, and experiments seen nowhere else. With your help, I can maintain the show as a commercial-free broadcast we all can enjoy. But a key part in that process is reaching out to encourage me and show your appreciation. In the meantime, I would like to thank you for listening and doing what you can to help share my work with others. Until next time, stay curious.